believe the rage inside her. While Siobhan had been raking her over scorching emotional coals, her husband had been upstairs, hiking Julie Jackson's skirt and bending her over in the guest bedroom. There wasn't a doubt in Claire's mind. She lowered her voice to a whisper. You were fucking her. Whoa, Jason said. His eyebrows shot up. Don't deny it, Claire said. The two of you were upstairs alone together. I'm not stupid, Jason. Jason set his beer bottle down on the table behind him with a thud. I was showing her the half-round trim detail in the master bedroom, he said. She and Brent are starting their addition, and she asked to see it. Oh, yeah, I bet, Claire said. Are you accusing me of cheating on you? Jason said. Is that honestly what you're doing? His voice was very loud, and although they were separated from the rest of the party by a wall, the people going to and from the bathroom could see them and maybe hear them. And Adams and Heidi Fisk were peering at them from the doorway of the living room. Making a scene at a party like this was a very bad idea. Everyone would be talking about it in the morning. Jason grabbed Claire's arm. Let's go ask Julie what we were doing upstairs. Come on, right now, so you can hear it for yourself. Let's go find her. No, Claire said. God, no. The last thing she wanted was some kind of messy confrontation in the kitchen with everyone watching. Claire would never be able to look Julie in the eye again. You just accused me of fucking her, Jason said. After 15 years of being together, 13 years of marriage, and 4 kids at home, you think I would desecrate all that by fooling around with one of your friends at a party? Is that how little you think of me? She's very pretty, Claire said. You're very pretty, Jason was screaming now. This has nothing to do with pretty. This has to do with you accusing me. This has to do with you not trusting me. Me, Jason Crispin, your husband. Do you honestly think I would cheat on you? He was hot now, hopping mad. First her best friend, now her husband. Why tonight? What had she done wrong? You didn't want to fool around at home, Claire said. We were going to be late, Jason said, and my back is killing me. Then you drove like a bat out of hell. So you thought what? That I couldn't wait to get here so I could take Julie Jackson upstairs? Well, Claire said, do you really think I'm having an affair? Jason said, do you really think I'm that kind of lowlife, that kind of skunk? It's dark upstairs, she said, pitch black. What was I supposed to think? You think I'm a cheating scum, like your father. Come on, we're leaving. No, we're leaving. I'll get our coats. Claire sat down on the bottom step and held her burning face. In the other room, the music was getting louder. Couples were probably dancing, and Siobhan had probably popped the cork on a bottle of vintage Moet. But Claire and Jason Crispin were leaving. Jason threw her pashmina at her. Here. But Siobhan... Siobhan would really be mad at her now, for picking a fight at her party, for leaving early. Let's go, Jason said. They marched out of the house, slamming the door. When they were on the sidewalk, Carter stuck his head out. Jace, man, where you going? My wife's dragging me home. Already? Dude, we still have food coming. I'm grilling sirloin. Sorry, man, Jason said. He climbed into the truck, and Claire climbed into the truck, and they sat there, cold and silent and seething. Claire said, you stay. No, Jason said. Fine, then I'll stay. No, Jason said. You can't tell me what to do, she said. You don't own me. She kicked her high heel at the glove box. I hate this truck. Jason said nothing, and this infuriated her. I think it is so stupid the way you've named this truck Darth Vader. Ever considered what an imbecile it makes you seem like to drive a truck named Darth Vader? Jason deftly extracted the truck from their parallel parking place and gunned it for home. Claire braced herself with one hand against the dash. When they passed under a streetlight, Claire saw Jason's face. His mouth was a pinched line. When they screeched into the driveway, Jason yanked the keys from the ignition. His eyes were filled with tears. He said, "I call the truck Darth Vader because the kids like it. They think it's funny." Claire stared at him, defiant. She would not be a shrinking violet. She would not wilt. But Jason, in tears? This was new. This was awful. This was something she had done. She bowed her head. Jason was not an imbecile. He was not stupid, small-minded, backward, or limited. He was a man who liked to see his kids smile, who liked to hear squeals of terrified delight, Shay, when he revved the truck's engine in a menacing way. And Jason was not a cheater. When Claire had seen Jason coming down the stairs with Julie Jackson, she had thought, "I know what that means." She had seen herself. Claire was cheating. Claire was lying. Claire had had sex with Locke Dixon on the conference table in the Nantucket's children boardroom. She'd had sex with Locke countless times in her own car, the Pilot, which she now did not allow Jason to ride in. Claire had projected her behavior onto Jason. She had splattered it all over him like paint. Claire was the skunk. The following morning, Claire woke up with the worst hangover of her life. It wasn't just the alcohol, although her head hammered with pain and her stomach squelched, and she released foul gas that Jason certainly would have complained about had he been in bed. But Jason's side of the bed was empty, smooth. It had never been slept in. He had spent the night in the guest room, which they had agreed never to do except in case of marital emergency, because J.D. and Ottilie were both old enough to construe what this meant, and neither Claire nor Jason wanted stories, true or false, about their sleeping arrangements leaving the house. So the fact that Jason had spent the night in the guest room indicated that matters were dire indeed. Claire had insulted him. She had called his love and his character into question, and what offense was worse than that? Once they were inside the house, and once Pan had slipped away to her room, Claire tried to explain that she had been upset by her conversation with Siobhan, and she'd been drinking her fourth or fifth glass of wine. And when she'd seen Jason and Julie coming down the stairs, she'd jumped to conclusions. She'd accused him, yes, but she was sorry, and she begged him to take into consideration the circumstances. "The circumstances are," Jason had said, stumbling over his own soapbox located 6 feet from the TV, remote control in hand, "that you suck." He'd turned the set on and begun hunting for junkyard wars. Claire, meanwhile, got a glass of water for herself and said, "Come to bed, I'll make it up to you." She was not used to fighting with Jason. They had divided up their life into his territory and her territory. They ruled peacefully side by side, and their common ground, the marriage, rarely came up as a topic of conversation the way it had tonight. Tonight, their marriage was the Gaza Strip. But even so, Claire was pretty sure she could win Jason over in the usual way. "No," Jason said. "You're turning down sex again?" she said. "I'm sleeping in the guest room," he said. She had alienated her husband, and she had alienated her best friend. The first had happened suddenly. The second had been taking place slowly, over the course of 6 months. Claire felt despicable. Her heart was pumping out black blood, sludge, sewage. She could barely lift her head off the pillow or move her feet to the floor. Could she go back to 6 o'clock last night and start over? Could she go back to that lunch at the yacht club and politely decline? Say to Lockhart Dixon, "Thank you so much for thinking of me, but I have to decline." Could she simply stay in bed all day, as she used to in college, on any one of the mornings when she woke up full of hungover regret? She had done 6 tequila slammers, hooked up with a frat boy from URI whose last name she didn't know, and then stopped by Cumberland Farms at 2 in the morning and chowed 2 hot dogs with chili and onions. But at least back in those days, despite her regrettable behavior, she could sleep. Now, she heard Zach upstairs crying. God only knew where the other kids were. It was Sunday, Pan's day off. Insult to injury. Claire pulled on her yoga clothes, brushed her teeth, and climbed the stairs. Her head felt like a glass ball blown out too thin, one that was sure to shatter in the annealer. Zack was howling. JD was on the computer in the hallway playing the god-awful race car game. He was obsessed with it. Jason allowed it because the game wasn't violent. Wasn't violent, but was so hypnotizing that JD didn't seem to hear his brother screaming in the other room. "Do you not hear your poor brother?" Claire said. "What do you want me to do about it?" JD said. "He doesn't want me, he wants you." Claire felt like smacking him, but JD was unconsciously mimicking his father. It was Jason who spoke to Claire like she was his feeble-minded servant. Jason, who conveyed the preposterous idea that Claire was the only person in the family responsible for Zack, perhaps because she was the one who had almost killed him. Claire peered into the guest room. The bed was empty and made up. "Have you seen Daddy this morning?" Claire asked. "He went to work," JD said.
"Work?"
"Deadline," he said.
"Right, but it's Sunday, day of rest."
JD did not see fit to respond to this. He got sucked right back into his game.
"Where are your sisters?"
He did not answer this either. Claire went into the baby's room and lifted Zack out of his crib. He was red-faced and nearly inconsolable, hiccupy, hysterical. He was the saddest baby Claire had ever seen, and even after she picked him up, he bellowed and struggled for breath, perhaps because he sensed she was not really there. Ottilie came out of her bedroom wearing her nightgown over her jeans. There had been one inexplicable morning when she'd asked to wear this exact ensemble to school.
"Come on down in a few minutes," Claire said. "I'm going to make breakfast."
"I'm not hungry," Ottilie announced.
"Doesn't matter," Claire said. "You have to eat."
"I'm not hungry, because Shay threw up in her bed and the smell made me lose my appetite."
"Shay threw up in bed? No, she didn't."
Ottilie nodded her head at the closed bathroom door.
"She's in there."
Claire put her ear to the door. She heard Shay gagging and spitting. She knocked.
"Shay, honey, are you okay?"
Moaning.
"And it's all over her bed," Ottilie said. "And there's some on the rug. It smells disgusting."
"Okay," Claire said, thinking. Jason working, to spite her, to punish her. Pan's day off. One kid screaming, one kid puking, two kids aggressively unhelpful. Hurting head, heavy heart. No best friend anymore. And lover in Tortola. It felt just, though. It felt right. Claire thought of Father Dominic. This was her penance. Claire jimmied open the door to the bathroom. She rubbed Shay's back while Shay expelled the contents of her stomach into the toilet. And Ottilie was correct. It did smell disgusting. It made Claire want to vomit herself, all those mini crab cakes churned in her stomach.
"Any idea what it was, honey? Did you eat too much candy last night or too much greasy popcorn?"
"No,"
Shay moaned. "No," which made Claire fear it was a virus that would mow down the family. She stripped Shay of her pajamas and put her naked, teeth brushed, into the bed in the guest room. The guest room linens were among Claire's most valuable possessions. Crisp, white, about 6,000 thread count, embroidered with sage green thread around the edges. There were 10 pillows on the bed, including two foam slabs encased in European shams that were emblazoned with the letter C. The guest bed was an extravagance. It was fit for a Turkish pasha, and Shay was so delighted to be allowed to snuggle naked beneath the fine, smooth cotton and the green chenille blanket and the fluffy down comforter that she seemed to perk up immediately. Either that or she was experiencing the imminent sense of wellness one felt after vomiting. Claire hoped, prayed, that Shay would not vomit on the sheets. On the guest room nightstand was a glass pitcher and cup for water, which Claire filled in the bathroom. She set it down for Shay.
"Don't drink too much right away, okay, honey?"
"Okay."
"And if you feel sick, you have to promise me you'll run to the bathroom."
"I promise."
Claire looked at her daughter. Her red hair was damp and matted, and her round cheeks were flushed pink,
Only her slender torso and two toothpicky but deceptively strong arms were visible above the bed's fluff. Shay was a miracle, Claire thought, and her eyes filled with tears. All of her children were miracles, especially the one whimpering in her arms. I love you, she told Shay.
I know that,
Shay said, unaware of or unimpressed by Claire's gush of emotion.
Can I watch TV?
Yes, there was a TV in the guest room, hidden in a cabinet opposite the pencil post bed. With so many amenities for guests, it was amazing they didn't have more visitors. The idea of four kids frightened many off. But Matthew would stay in this room in August. Claire really did not want Shay to throw up on the million-dollar sheets. She went to the linen closet and pulled out a bucket, placed it by Shay's bed. Just in case, she said. A note from Jason on the kitchen counter said, working. Claire poured herself coffee, then a glass of water, and she took three Advil. It was a beautiful day outside, sunny, springtime. They only got 2 or 3 days like this, and they should be taking advantage of it. Picnic at Great Point, a walk around Squam Swamp. Something outside, wholesome, as a family. She hugged Zach, kissed his eyelids, his nose. I love you, she said. Can I put you in your high chair, please, so I can get breakfast? He clung to her. He would not be set down. It was impossible to deal with frying bacon, mixing up pancake batter, or stirring chocolate powder into milk when she didn't have hands. She poured J.D. and Ottilie bowls of cereal, and then called upstairs for them to come down. She tried to interest Zach in a banana, but he just stared at it. Banana? She said. You eat it. She took a bite, then regretted it. See? Claire eyed the phone. Should she call Jason on his cell and try apologizing again? Should she call Siobhan? It wasn't even 7:30 yet, and unlike Claire's kids, Liam and Aiden had been known to sleep until noon on the weekends, so no, she couldn't call Siobhan. And what would she say when she did call? Should she promise to call Edward and deal with the catering issue? She couldn't. She had delegated the catering to Edward. He and his committee had made a decision, and now Claire's hands were tied. The other, more substantive issue rested like a boulder between them. Claire hadn't told her about Locke. Claire wasn't going to tell her about Locke. Claire called up to J.D. and Ottilie again. She could hear the goddamn Doppler effect of the race car game, but she knew they wouldn't come down, and when they did come down and found cold cereal, they would complain. So forget it. Breakfast was a lost cause. She slipped into the home office, Zach heavy against her chest, and switched on the computer. Computer, she said, pointing to the screen. Locke was due home in the morning. Finally, finally. There was no way he had expended the psychic energy on her that she had on him. She was angry at herself, but helpless too. She couldn't control her thoughts, and as had been demonstrated last night, she could only marginally control her words and actions, and they all led back to him. She opened her email. There was the ill-fated message from Edward, copied to Isabel and Lauren Van Aln, and the two women from New York who were also on the catering committee. There was no email from Locke. Claire squeezed Zach, kissed his hair. Upstairs, she heard Shay retching. She had never felt so lonely in all her life. She fell asleep across her bed with Zach next to her, which was, she realized when she woke up, a precious gift, despite the fact that she had left the other three children, one of them sick, unparented. She checked the clock. It was nearly 10. There were no sounds from upstairs, which alarmed her. Better she should hear the zooming of the godforsaken race car game, or Shay retching, if only to know the kids were still alive. She poked her head into the kitchen. Everything was just as it had been. Jason's infuriating note, 2 uneaten bowls of Cheerios. She tried to feed a few Cheerios to Zach, who had resumed his position on her shoulder. She was a pirate, he was her squawking parrot, but he clamped his mouth shut. Upstairs, the computer was abandoned. J.D.'s room empty, bed unmade, pajamas in a pile on the floor instead of in the hamper, and the girl's room empty and reeking. Claire had forgotten to strip the bed of the vomited-upon sheets. She, the laundry queen, had forgotten the second most important thing after getting Shay situated. Now the room smelled sour and vile, the odor made worse by the fact that the day was warm and the girls' windows closed. But first, the children. The door to the guest room was shut tight, and there was no noise leaking from within, not even the muted babble of the Cartoon Network. Claire hated it, and would only allow it in her weakest moments. Claire eased the door open, resolved that what she would find inside would not be to her liking, and there she found Shay, asleep upright against the unforgiving bolster of the sea pillows, and at the foot of the bed, Ottilie and J.D., quietly drawing. It was adorable, really. When was the last time Claire had seen the two of them doing quiet, productive work together? It had been years. J.D. was sketching with a set of sharp pencils. He was drawing houses. He wanted to be an architect. Ottilie was coloring with a set of special markers that Claire had ordered from a catalog. When Claire entered, the kids looked up and smiled shyly, knowing that although they hadn't eaten a bite of breakfast, there was no way she could be anything but happy with them. They were doing creative work and keeping watch over their sick sister. Model children, two more miracles, or so Claire would have thought had her eyes not landed swiftly on Ottilie's special, ordered from a catalog, fuchsia marker, which had the cap off and was bleeding ink in a perfect circle onto the precious white duvet cover. The duvet cover was ruined. It was such a stupid thing in comparison with everything else, but it was the thing that made Claire's throat tighten. It was the thing that nearly made her cry. "Come down to breakfast," she sniffled. At 10:30, the phone rang. Claire was upstairs trying to strip the vomity sheets off the bed with Zach clinging to her neck, and the sound of the phone took her by surprise. She zipped downstairs to get it. Siobhan, she thought, and her heart lightened. Or Jason, or Locke. But no, it was Sunday. He would never in a million years call her house on a Sunday. The caller ID said, "Unknown number." Telemarketer, she thought, her heart sinking. Zach started to bang his head against her breastbone and cry. It was not a good time to take a call, but Claire was grateful that anyone wanted to talk to her, even a salesperson. She picked up the phone. "Hello?"
"Claire?"
It was a man. It was Locke? It was not Locke, but the voice was as familiar as Locke's voice. It was ringing the same bells in her head. "Yes?" she said.
"It's me."
She paused, then said tentatively, "Me who?"
"Matthew."
"Oh," she said, astonished. "Matthew? Really? It was Matthew? Oh, God, I can't believe it."
"You got my message," he said, "back in
October. Yes, I got it."
"I'm home now," he said. "Well, not home, but in California."
Zach was crying. Claire couldn't hear Matthew. She said, "Can you hang on a second?"
"Is this a bad time?"
"No," she said. "No, God, no." The voice all of a sudden made sense. It clicked. That famous voice. It had been so long. "I have to talk to you. I mean, I need a friend, and all of my other friends, and my husband, for that matter. Well, I've pissed them off. I'm pretty much persona non grata around here."
"That makes two of us," he said.
"Hold on one second," she said. She set the phone down and tried to shush Zach, but he was in a full-blown tizzy. There was nothing she could do with him. But she wanted to talk to Matthew. They had known and loved each other long before Jason or Siobhan or Locke had come into her life, and there was a reason he was calling now, this morning. It was a sign. It was what she needed. She buckled. She had no choice. She knocked on Pan's bedroom door. Pan opened the door a crack. She was wearing a gray athletic shirt and black panties, and her hair was in her face. She had been asleep. I am so, so sorry, Claire said, but can you please, please hold him for 10 minutes? I have to take a very important phone call. Pan did not respond, and Claire thought maybe she was sleepwalking. Zack lunged for her, and Pan reached out instinctively, took Zack, and shut the door. Thank you, Claire said to the closed door. Thanks, Pan. 10 minutes. She hurried back to the phone. Are you still there?
I'm here.
Thank God, Claire said. She moved outside and settled on the top step of the deck, where she sat in the sun. She was warm, outside, for the first time in months. Thank God you called me.
Tell me what's happening, Matthew said. Tell me everything.
Only then did Claire cry. Max West was a rock star, yes. He had played for the Sultan of Brunei, the Dalai Lama, an amphitheater full of Buddhist monks. He had won Grammys and met presidents. But he was her childhood, her adolescence. He was a part of her. He was who she used to be, and he was who she still was somewhere deep inside. Back when they were friends, before they were lovers, he would come to her house on Saturday mornings and help her with her chores, dusting and vacuuming the front of the house. Before he had his growth spurt, he would stand on top of the vacuum and Claire would push him around the living room. He showed up one time in the middle of the night and found Claire asleep with her hair wrapped in treated paper to straighten it, and they both laughed until they nearly wet their pants. His junior year, he drove a 1972 yellow Volkswagen Bug that had no turn signals and no ignition, and even in February, when it was 15 below zero, he had to crank down his windows and stick his arm out so that oncoming traffic would know he was turning. He had to run alongside that car to get it started, and Claire was right there with him, running, pushing, hopping into the passenger side. He worked as a busboy one summer at a seafood restaurant on the boardwalk, and Claire would meet him after his shift, and once in a while he would pull lobster tails from behind his back. They were extras, a gift from the cook. They used to eat the lobsters with their bare hands in the dunes, looking at the black ocean. On those nights of the pilfered lobsters, the breeze in her face, and Matthew's bare leg knocking against hers, and the hour growing so late that the lights of the boardwalk were shutting down behind them, she felt something rare. She thought to herself, I never want my life to change. But change it did. I'm okay, Claire sobbed. How had she gotten here? So far away from that dune in Wildwood. She lived somewhere else now, and she had 4 children and a husband and a career and a house and a best friend and a lover and this unwieldy commitment that was causing her so much angst. But the gala was also bringing Matthew back to her, and along with Matthew, these memories. They gave her strength, if only because they were reminding her of who she was at her core. But this second, she was like Zack. She couldn't stop crying, despite the sunshine. You talk first. You tell me.
I'm drinking again, Matthew said. I'm drunk now.
Oh, Claire said, through a blockage of teary snot in her nose. Oh, no.
Yes, he said. I was away for months, on tour. I was in Asia, remote Indonesia, far-flung islands with dragons. And I was in wildest Borneo, where there are still cannibals. It was a freak show. I thought I could handle it, but then my sponsor got sick and left me on top of a volcano in Flores, where the lakes were pink, purple, and turquoise because of mineral deposits. The lakes were mind-blowing. They were like something Disney came up with, but they were real. And then my sponsor, Jerry, Christian fellow, got really fucking sick. And I could tell you that that was when I lost my way, but the fact of the matter is, I lost my way well before that. I started drinking in the airplane bathroom before we even left LAX, and basically, never stopped.
No.
Yes. When I came home to California, Bess divorced me. I let her down, she said. She wasn't willing to do it anymore, and I said, you knew I was vulnerable. You should have come with me.
Yes, why didn't she?
She hates touring, hates it. She's a homebody. She didn't want to leave the dogs.
Ah, Claire said, sniffling. The dogs.
So, we're done. It's over. She's going to marry my accountant and have children. I'm giving her $3 million, even though she claims she doesn't want it. And she doesn't want the house, even though she helped design it and decorate it in that zen-ish best way. But I can't live in it. It's her house. So we're selling it. But she's there for the time being with the dogs. She's taking custody of the dogs, of course. And I'm renting a place in the hills, trying to keep myself to 2 gin and tonics per hour.
Oh, Matthew.
I know. This is the bottom. Everyone thought the bottom was when Savannah and I got caught coming out of the Beverly Hills Hotel.
That was pretty bad.
That was just a media blitz, except for the fact that the husband took a contract out on me with the Belarusian mob. They tried to kill me.
Well, no one's threatening to kill you now, Claire said, so this is better.
It's worse, he said, because I am very slowly killing myself.
You have to stop, Claire said.
I can't stop.
Right. She had seen it in the tabloids, in and out of rehab, where he was treated and deprogrammed, medicated and talked to. But as soon as he got out, as soon as he was left to his own devices, he sought the very thing he was trying to stay away from. Claire understood it now, better than she ever had before, because she was addicted to Locke. She was unable to give him up, despite the fact that staying with him was ruining her life. You can't stop, she whispered.
It's a disease, he said.
Claire thought back to Labor Day weekend, 1986, a few nights before their senior year was to begin. There was a late-night party in an empty rental house thrown by their friend E.K., whose mother was a real estate agent. There was beer. There was strip poker. Claire, for some reason, was the only girl at the party after midnight, or the only girl playing strip poker, and Matthew did not want her to take her clothes off. But that was the game, so she took them off, unconcerned, because E.K. and Jeffrey and Jonathan Cross and everyone else were her good buddies, buddies since nursery school. They were like brothers. Claire sat in the circle, practically naked, feeling skinny and sexless. They were her brothers. But Matthew got quietly upset. He drank and drank and drank, and when the sun came up and they all got dressed again, Claire had to carry Matthew to his doorstep. He was babbling, making no sense, saying, "You make me crazy. I love you. I'm crazy. You make me crazy, Claire Danner." Claire had considered leaving Matthew draped across his front porch, but she was afraid he would choke on his own vomit and die the way they were always warning you of in health class. So she tapped on the screen door, which brought sweet Jane Westfield outside with her cigarette and her cup of tea. Claire thought Jane would be mad. They had stayed out all night drinking. But Matthew had 4 older siblings all out of the house by that time, and sweet Jane was used to teenage shenanigans. She took Matthew inside and waved goodbye to Claire, and as Claire wandered down the Westfields walk, she heard Matthew say to his mother,
"That girl of mine makes me crazy."
When Claire thought of Labor Day weekend, 1986, she thought, that was when it started. Matthew's alcoholism. But that might have been her feeling pointlessly responsible again. No boundaries. The truth was, in the years since they'd both left Wildwood, Matthew had known excesses Claire couldn't even imagine.
Tell me about you, Matthew said. Tell me why you're sad. Never in a million years did I expect to call and find you sad. I never think of you as being sad. Remember when you told me that once you were out of your parents' house, your life was going to be perfect?
Huh, Claire said.
She had told Matthew that. She had promised herself she would leave Wildwood Crest with a clean slate, and her life had been happy. It had been blessed. Until... When had the trouble started? With Zach's birth? Or before that? On the night of Daphne's accident? Where would Claire start if she wanted to explain about Locke? What would she say? I love him the way I used to love you, with heedless abandon, with pure emotion in that aching, longing, dangerous way. I went to a party last night, she said, and I drank, and I had all this stuff on my mind. Then I had a fight with my best friend, Siobhan. It was her party, and the fight left me feeling horrible. And then I saw Jason coming down the stairs with this other friend of ours, this woman who was a complete knockout, and I accused him of sleeping with her, and God, it's a mess. I made a mess. Jason's not speaking to me, and Siobhan's not speaking to me, and our au pair probably isn't speaking to me. And I have one of my little girls upstairs vomiting, and I just feel bad about myself and confused. I'm looking at my life, and I'm saying, what happened? What am I doing? How did I get here? Do you ever feel that way?
All the time, Matthew said. It's fair to say I feel that way all the time.
But you're a big star, Claire said. Nobody gets mad at you.
Bess is mad. She's beyond mad. She's finished. My band is mad. Terry and Alfonso, they're disappointed and mad, and they have every right to be. I'm letting them down. I'm a big star, but guess what? I'm also a seriously flawed person. I can write songs and sing and play the guitar, but that doesn't mean I don't have weak spots and bad days like every other human being. We all fail, Claire.
She was crying again. I miss you, she said.
I miss you too, he said.
I have to hang up, but I'm gonna see you, right, in August? You'll stay here with us?
Yes, he said.
You have to stop drinking, she said. Just stop for 1 hour. Do you want me to call Bruce?
He knows all about it, Matthew said. He's on his way over here as we speak.
You have to be sober for my concert, Matthew, she said. For me, okay?
For you, he said. Okay.
Okay, Claire said. She hung up the phone and spent a moment enjoying the sun on her arms. She was feeling pain about the past 24 hours and pain from 20 years earlier. She was as confused now as she'd been then. The world and the people in it perplexed her. She perplexed herself.
Mommy?
She went inside. The vacation could have gone either way. Locke and Daphne were alone for 8 days and 7 nights. Things could have gotten better between them, or worse. They had taken 2 other vacations alone together since Daphne's accident, one to Kauai, one to London, and neither had done the trick. But there was always the lingering hope that this time would be different. This time, the sunshine or the pool or the amenities of the world-class resort would inspire the change Locke had been waiting for. Daphne would snap back into her old self. She would break out of the spell cast on her by her head injuries and wake up, like Snow White or Sleeping Beauty. Where have I been all this time? In the end, the vacation didn't go one way or the other.
Things between them remained the same. Which meant what? The 2 days at Andover were torture. Heather didn't want them there. She asked them to meet her off campus at a vegetarian restaurant in town. There were other students in the restaurant, some of whom waved to Heather and murmured her name, but Heather did not introduce Locke or Daphne to anyone. Locke couldn't say he blamed Heather, because Daphne, especially in front of people she had never met, was unpredictable. She began by harassing their waitress about her hair, which was knotted in dreadlocks.
"A nice white girl like you," Daphne said, only seconds after ordering a leek and Gruyere tart. "Sabotaging your looks with that awful hair. You don't wash it, is that it? What do your parents say?"
The waitress chose to ignore Daphne. She flushed as she scribbled down Locke's and Heather's orders, and then she fled from the table while Daphne, inexplicably, clucked like a chicken. Heather glowered, mortified.
"Mom," she said, "quit it."
"Quit what?" Daphne said. "I just wonder what her parents think."
Locke tried to serve as a buffer between his wife and his daughter. He tried to shield Heather from Daphne's attacks, but Daphne landed a few jabs anyway. "Heather's calves were too muscular," Daphne said. "You look like a boy. You should think about quitting hockey next year."
"But Mom," Heather said, "hockey is why I'm here."
"You don't want to turn into a lesbian, do you?" Daphne said. "I don't want you to turn into a lesbian."
"All right," Locke said. "That's enough."
Heather seemed happier when it was just her and Locke alone, after Daphne went back to the inn to rest. Heather took Locke onto campus, introduced him to her art history teacher, showed him her dorm room where he visited with Heather's roommate Desiree, whose parents had kindly taken Heather to Turks and Caicos. Desiree's parents also had a house on Martha's Vineyard, and Heather mentioned spending the summer there, and Locke said,
"Yes, or you and Desiree could spend the summer on Nantucket. We have plenty of room."
But Heather scowled at this, and Locke knew he would never be taken up on his offer. His daughter, at the tender age of 15, was gone, and this made him feel unspeakably angry at Daphne. But Daphne's manner was beyond her. What had the doctor said? It was like someone else was inside Daphne, manning the controls, some evil green alien, the wife and mother invader. Locke could not blame Heather for wanting to spend the summer on the vineyard. If given the chance, he might say yes to it himself. Before Locke returned to the inn to shower and change, they were going to a restaurant 30 miles away at Heather's suggestion. Heather said,
"You and Mom don't have to worry about me. I'm going to be fine."
Locke looked at his daughter. Her dark hair, her wide, pretty mouth, so much like Daphne's, her strong legs, her slender, feminine feet in espadrilles, and he nearly wept. He had expected to hear those words when she was ready to embark on her honeymoon, or when she was setting off for college, perhaps, but not now, at the age of 15. He thought he'd experienced and expelled all his sadness about losing his daughter's confidence and her company, but he was wrong. He felt it freshly now. He was so consumed with keeping things between Heather and Daphne on an even keel, it was exhausting, that he didn't have a second to think about Claire. That changed once Locke and Daphne pulled away from Phillips Academy, once they were alone together, with what seemed like an endless stretch of alone together time in front of them. Daphne stared out the window silently for a while, then started on a diatribe about Heather. Her legs were the legs of an 18-year-old boy, a cross-country runner with those ropey muscles. If she stayed at that school, she would most certainly become a lesbian. They had to pull her out. She seemed so unhappy anyway, didn't she? Positively morose. She hadn't smiled once the whole time they were there. And what to make of the vegetarianism? She had been raised on beef tenderloin. The school was to blame. So liberal, so forward-thinking, offering shameful alternatives to the way normal people lived. Had Locke happened to notice the hair on the girl who served them? Heather should move home. They could redecorate the basement, turned it into a hangout with an iPod station and the best speakers, a computer, a plasma TV, a refrigerator full of hummus, if that was what she wanted. Anything so she would come home. She's so set on privacy and independence, we'll just promise her we'll never go down there.
Locke was silent.
The idea wasn't terrible. Locke wanted Heather home as much as Daphne did, but he knew it was never going to happen. In response to Locke's silence, Daphne started to cry, and Locke reached over for her hand, which she flung away in anger.
"We should have had more children," she said. "I can't believe I let you talk me out of it."
It was pointless to remind her that after Heather was born, a cyst formed on one of Daphne's ovaries, and she'd had both ovaries removed. Blame for the fact that Heather was an only child had, since the accident, fallen squarely onto Locke's shoulders. At some point during the ride to the airport, Locke remembered Claire, although it would be inaccurate to say he'd forgotten her. Rather, he'd decided, out of fairness to Daphne and Heather, that he would do his best to contain his feelings for Claire. He would put them in a box, a small gold treasure chest, as he envisioned it, and keep it closed and locked. However, as Daphne railed against him for first one offense, then another, Locke opened the box. Just a crack. He pictured Claire driving to the grocery store, pulling a gather from her pot furnace, climbing into bed. In Locke's mind, she was alone, though in reality, he knew this was never the case. More images flowed out of the box. He heard Claire's clogs on the stairs of the Elijah Baker house as he waited, two glasses of wine in hand, breath suspended, for her to pop her head around the corner. "Hey, you?" He thought about wiping away the tears that often appeared in the corners of her eyes after they made love. Claire cried for a variety of reasons. The sex was astonishing. The rush of emotion overwhelmed her. She hated to leave him. It hurt, physically, to rip herself away. And, too, there was guilt. About Jason, about Daphne, about the kids. And there was fear. Fear of getting caught. Fear of going to hell. Nearly every time they were together, they talked about stopping, about walking away in the name of a righteous life. But neither of them ever followed through. It was cathartic to talk about, but impossible to execute, leaving each other. They felt ecstatic, elated, anxious, guilt-ridden, despicable. But mostly, they felt alive. Each day was spring-loaded and tense with possibility. To see each other, to talk, to touch. And it was this emotion that was too intoxicating to give up. The actual vacation, although parts of it were pleasant, the hot sun, the cool, clear blue water, the delicious food and drinks, the luxurious room, the attentive service, felt to Locke like a vacuum. It was an 8-day, 7-night tunnel of no Claire. It was something to be survived. He had promised Claire he would email, and in fact, the resort had a business center he could have used at any time, but he felt that communicating with her, trying to put words to his emptiness and then subjecting himself to the added torture of awaiting a response, would be infinitely more painful than just putting his head down and enduring. He and Daphne spent long, silent hours by the pool, each of them reading, and while Daphne napped, Locke took walks on the beach, thinking not of Claire, always of Claire, but of what topics he could bring up at dinner that would not incite a verbal attack from Daphne. She did seem marginally better at the resort, though she found ways to insult the other guests, who were primarily British, and therefore reserved and inclined to keep to themselves, especially when they heard Daphne lapse into her clucking. There were two evenings of intimacy, and these were perhaps the most trying times for Locke. Sexually, Daphne was both aggressive and impossible to please. Locke, helped along by three rum punches, strove to remember Daphne as she used to be, before she took to assaulting his manhood at the same time that she was trying to excite him. It was during these intimate moments that Locke thought to himself,
I cannot stay married to this woman. He would not be able to stand a lifetime of such sexual encounters, but he also knew he would never be able to cut Daphne loose, no matter how bad things got. There wasn't another man alive who would be willing to take Daphne on, and her parents had passed away. So what this meant was that if Locke abandoned her, she would become Heather's lot, and Locke could not, would not, burden his daughter that way. He would stay with Daphne. The best moments of the vacation were when Daphne would look up from her book, take a sip of her rum punch, and say,
Thanks, babe.
This, the pet name that the two of them had used with each other, and with Heather, before the accident. For bringing me here. I'm having fun.
The worst moment came at dinner on the final night. It was no surprise that Daphne had saved her poison spear for the final night. That was part of the torture, allowing Locke to believe that they'd made it, a whole week without overt hostility, and then sticking him in the final hour. Daphne was smarter, cleverer, and more cunning now than she had been before the accident. Over a glass of very fine, pale, bubbling champagne, she said,
I have a question for you.
Shoot.
Do you find Isabel French attractive?
Locke laughed, inadvertently spritzing some of his drink across the tablecloth.
No, he said.
You're lying.
I am not lying.
Isabel French is a beautiful woman. Anyone you asked would say so.
She's fine, nothing special. Other people may find her beautiful, but I don't particularly. I've known her a long time, maybe I'm just used to how she looks. I don't notice it.
She's after you.
Don't be ridiculous, Daphne.
You heard what she did with Henry McGarvey at the Waldorf.
Of course. If you touch her, I'll kill you. I'm not going to touch her.
I mean it. I'll murder you in your sleep. Then I'll find a female judge who will let me off the hook.
Nothing is going on between me and Isabel.
Really?
Daphne said. She tilted her head. Her eyes held a look of unusual clarity.
Because I've noticed a change in you since you asked her to co-chair the gala. You work late all the time now.
I've always worked late. Locke said. It's the only time I get anything done. You know this. During the day, the phone rings off the hook.
Locke,
Daphne said. She leaned forward over her champagne flute. Another inch, and she would topple it with her breasts.
I am not a stupid woman. No one thinks you are, least of all me.
And yet, you're conducting an affair under my nose.
Locke thought he might feel something at this declaration, but it fell into a pattern with Daphne's other rants. She started out with an innocent question. Did he find Isabel French attractive? Then ramped up to a flat-out accusation. It was a little more troublesome in this instance because she happened to be partially correct. She sensed something.
I am not having an affair with Isabel French,
Locke said with conviction.
And I do not like being accused of such on the last night of what has been a very pleasant vacation.
Daphne looked amused.
Tell me you love me.
I love you.
I've been thinking of hiring a private detective.
You have got to be kidding.
She took a long sip of her drink. Okay, now Locke's blood pressure was up a little bit, and then she said,
Yes.
He almost lashed out at her. She was infuriating. It was inconceivable that she was constantly unearthing new ways to rattle him. Would it never end? Would she ever level off? Would he ever truly be the fortress he thought he was, inured to her attacks? But she chuckled a little and turned her attention to the menu, and Locke let the stream of breath he had unconsciously been holding go and thought,
Isabel French, Jesus.
When Locke arrived home from vacation, when he was finally back in the office, sorting through the neatly organized piles that Gavin had left on his desk, thoughts of Tortola and the hot sun and the cool water and the books he had read and Daphne and her taunts of a private detective all faded away. All Locke could think about was when he might see Claire.
"How was your vacation?" Gavin asked.
Locke stared at him blankly, then said,
"We had good weather."
Locke called Claire's cell phone and said quickly, even though he had prudently waited until Gavin left for the bank with a deposit,
"I'm back. Can you stop by later to pick up the... maybe 7 o'clock?
Daylight savings time had ended, though. 7 o'clock was too early. It was still light outside at 7. They had to stay in the office, hidden. They couldn't tool around in her car. Locke should push her back to 8, but he would never be able to wait that long. So, Claire came at 7. Locke heard her running up the stairs, yes, running, and that echoed in his heart. His heart was running. God, only a few more seconds until... He met her at the top of the stairs. He didn't even look at her. He didn't have to. He didn't care what she looked like anyway. He just wanted her in his arms. He crushed her, and she was crying, and he was struggling for air, overwhelmed as he was with love, relief, comfort, peace.
"That was too long," he said. "I'm sorry."
"I nearly died without you," she said. "Everything went to pot."
"I could barely breathe at times," he said. "I missed you so much."
"Never go away again," she said. "Never leave me like that."
"Okay," he said. "I won't."
It was a rush, a torrent. The week following his return from Tortola, he saw Claire 4 times. 4 times! It was unprecedented, unsafe. But Locke told Daphne, truthfully, "You should see the work that stacked up on my desk while I was away." And Jason had some kind of deadline at the end of the month, and he was working even later than Claire stayed out. He was angry at her anyway. They'd had an argument, and Jason was sleeping alternately in the guest room or on the sofa. Locke had heard about this. He'd heard about Edward and Siobhan. Siobhan wasn't speaking to Claire either. They had not talked in almost 7 days. And he'd heard about Zach's birthday and the encouraging news from the pediatrician. He and Claire had to catch up in bits and pieces because most of their time was spent holding each other, reassuring each other that they were really there. In a way, it was the best week they'd ever had. Their emotions ran from rapture to delirium and back again. The despair of being apart was in their past. Guilt had been suspended, as had fear. Their first thoughts were not of being careful. Twice Locke had to keep Claire from embracing him in front of the 20-paned window. The private detective, stupidly, haunted him. Their first thoughts were only of each other. Gavin took advantage of the week Locke was away to steal. He skimmed off every check that came into the office, including a check for $50,000 from a prestigious women's shoe company in New York, which Isabel French had enlisted to underwrite the gala. He kept $1,000 for himself. He had nearly $10,000 in cash stowed away in the utensil drawer of his parents' kitchen. Gavin found taking money while Locke was gone almost too easy. He was able to cover his tracks, then double-check and triple-check that they were covered. It lacked the risk of skimming funds right under Locke's nose. It was almost more quickening to pilfer money from petty cash for his lunch, which he also did each day Locke was on vacation. Gavin was happy to see Locke return, not only because it put the fun back into his game, but because Gavin had missed his employer. Locke was a truly wonderful man. This had come into clearer focus after Locke had gone away. Gavin felt bad about deceiving him, but this guilt only added extra oomph to Gavin's treachery. He fantasized all the time about getting caught. He had a favorite scenario in which he invited Locke and Daphne to his parents' house for dinner, and in an attempt to locate a serving fork or an extra dessert spoon, one of them opened the utensil drawer and discovered the money, and they said, "Where did you get all this money?" Though they knew there could only be one place. "I am a thief." Gavin thought this all the time now. He had come around from considering it skimming. Skimming was back when his cash was merely hundreds, but now that it was about to top five figures, it qualified as stealing. He was a thief, and clearly his mind had been ruined, as his mother had always feared, by movies and TV, because his self-image took on a more and more glamorous sheen. Instead of seeing himself as a rotten, dishonest brat who was freeloading off his parents and now taking important funds from little kids whose lives were infinitely more difficult than his had ever been, he put himself in a category with Brad Pitt in Ocean's 11, someone who disarmed elaborate security systems, cracked codes, slipped on velvet gloves. There were fissures, however, cracks in his resolve, through which his panic escaped. He could not get caught. It wasn't that he had much to lose. The nitty-gritty facts were that if he got caught, he would have to move out of his parents' house, and he would lose his job and his three or four friends. But all of that was going into the rubbish bin anyway, once he had enough money. How much was enough? 100,000? Could he actually take 100,000 and not get caught? He was leaving. He was off to an island in Southeast Asia, so remote it didn't even have a name, at least not one pronounceable to native speakers of English. It was important to Gavin, however, that he leave on his own terms, in glory, as it were. The people of Nantucket would learn he was a thief, but by then it would be too late. He would have vanished, never to be heard from again. He would have gotten away with it. It was imperative that Gavin get away with it. Unlike the debacle at Cap'n Lehigh, where he'd had his hand slapped like a little boy, where his crime had been categorized as naive and juvenile, it was important that he succeed in this one thing. And, too, he was having fun. If he got caught, the fun would come to an abrupt halt. One night, the week after Locke returned, Gavin experienced unprecedented panic. He was at dinner with Rosemary Pinkle, the recently widowed woman Gavin had befriended at the Episcopal Church. They were both fans of the Evensong service, and their friendship had grown to encompass monthly dinners out. These dinners sustained Gavin's altruistic side and reinforced his belief that he was not a complete loss in the human kindness department. He listened to Rosemary's stories about her departed husband with careful attention. Rosemary and Clive Pinkle had traveled extensively, and Rosemary's stories were fascinating. She did on occasion lapse into unexpected moments of melancholy. She shed tears, she broke down into sobs, at which point Gavin held her hand, hoping that should his father die first, there would be a young man in Chicago who would fill a similar role for his mother. On the night in question, Rosemary was in high spirits. She was a gardener and heartened by the fine weather and by the fact that the deer were staying away from her tulips. She and Gavin were eating at American Seasons, newly opened for the season, a further harbinger of summer. Just as Gavin was delving into his cream of sorrel soup, he was struck by a paralyzing thought. That afternoon at work, he had sent out a letter to the Women's Shoe Company in New York, thanking them for their underwriting donation and confirming the 501c3 status of Nantucket's children, making the donation tax deductible. As Rosemary detailed to him how she had outsmarted the deer, she had sprinkled the mulch around the tulips with human hair collected from a salon in town, Gavin questioned the amount he had typed in the letter. The check had been for $50,000.
He had deposited $50,000 and taken $1,000 as cash, making the net deposit $49,000. That number, $49,000, was the number that stuck in Gavin's mind, and he became more and more fearful as he pretended to eat his soup and as he pretended to listen to Rosemary. The salon had been glad to get rid of the hair, that he had typed in $49,000 as the amount of the donation instead of $50,000. The letter had been signed by Locke, who did not read it, stamped, and taken to the post office. However, if Gavin had indeed typed in $49,000 instead of $50,000, someone from the women's shoe company would call to inquire, and this would cause either Locke or Adams Fisk to look more closely into the matter. Gavin tried to remember. He was hyper-aware of every detail of his crime. He would have been paying attention when he wrote this letter, right? But that was the problem. He could not remember typing in the figure $50,000, and he did not remember double-checking it before he took it over to Locke's desk for a signature. Gavin did not remember typing $49,000 either, but this was the amount he subconsciously attached to the donation. Gavin's heart was slamming in his chest. He was growing warm, and he had to yank his tie free of his neck. It was strangling him, though of course he hated to do it because there was nothing quite as distasteful as a man with a sloppy necktie. Gavin was positive now that if he had been working from his subconscious, if he wrote the letter on autopilot, which he must have since he couldn't remember the most important detail of the letter, then he might have typed in $49,000 instead of $50,000. Locke did not read the letter because he never read the letters. They were all the same, and because Gavin had been looming over Locke's desk with barely concealed impatience. He wanted to get to the bank. He wanted a cigarette, and some of the letters Locke was signing had been waiting for 12 days. Locke had not noticed the amount. He was tired from his vacation, and if Gavin could put his 2 cents in, he seemed distracted, as if he had left his ability to focus back in Tortola. Plus, there was never a reason to check Gavin's work because Gavin never made mistakes. It was bound to happen sometime, though, and it had happened today. Gavin set his spoon on the plate, resting under his soup bowl. He could not eat another bite. Rosemary noticed this. In so many ways, she was like his mother. "Eat up, eat up." "Are you finished?" she said. "Is it not good?" "I don't feel well," Gavin said. He could not get caught. Okay, say a representative from the women's shoe company did call. Chances were Gavin would answer the phone. But what if the call came while Gavin was at lunch? What if the call came before Gavin got in the morning, or after he'd left in the evening? What if it came in while he was in the bathroom or on another call? Locke would answer. The sheer torture of waiting for that phone call would be enough to land Gavin in the funny farm. The waitress came to clear his plate. Gavin said, "It was very good, I just don't feel well." Rosemary leaned forward. She was attuned to people who didn't feel well. Her husband, Clive, had gone to bed early one night complaining of heartburn and had died in his sleep. "Have some water," she said. The most crucial thing, the thing that was pressing with more and more urgency in his chest and lower in his bowels, was for him to go to the office and check the letter on his computer. Because what if he was mistaken? What if the amount did read $50,000? God, he would be so relieved. He would offer to pay for dinner. He would do more than offer. He would slip the waitress his credit card and ask her to run it without Rosemary's knowledge. Rosemary would be miffed. She always paid for dinner. In this, she was also like Gavin's mother. But she would be touched, too. He just had to excuse himself, dash to the office, check his computer, and race back. His heart sank. That would take too long. Rosemary would grow concerned. She would check on him in the bathroom or ask a male waiter to check on him,
and he wouldn't be there. And how would he explain that? But staying here through his rack of lamb and then coffee and dessert was not an option. He tugged at his tie some more, this time for effect. I hate to say this, but I think I have to go home.
Home? Rosemary said.
I think I'm going to be sick.
Oh, dear, Rosemary said. You'd better go then, yes, don't stay another second because of me.
I hate to walk out on you like this, Gavin said.
Go! I'll tell our waitress what's happened and settle the bill. Unless you want me to drive you home, do you want me to drive you?
No, Gavin said.
He was hunched over, trying to convey the immediacy of his distress.
I can drive. I need to get home.
Go,
Rosemary said. I'll call in a little while to check on you. He kissed her cheek.
You're a doll. I'm so sorry to
go,
Rosemary said. He humped through town, head down, pulling hasty, nervous drags off a cigarette, muttering to himself, praying this was all a mistake, a bad suspicion. Did all criminals suffer from such paranoia? They must. $49,000. Yes, the more he thought about it, the more certain he was that he'd blown it. But maybe not. God, he couldn't stand it. He hurried. He fumbled with his keys at the door. His hands were shaking. He was not particularly quiet. It had not occurred to him that Locke would still be in the office. It was nearly 8 o'clock. But when Gavin was halfway up the stairs, he heard voices. Locke was here. Shit. Gavin considered turning around and leaving, but no, he couldn't. He had to check that letter tonight. So what could he tell Locke he was doing? Getting a phone number, maybe, or an email address. Would that be plausible? As Gavin rifled through possibilities in his mind, he became alerted to the fact that something unusual was afoot in the office. There was bumping and banging, heavy breathing, a woman's voice. Gavin stopped where he was on the stairs and flattened himself against the wall, the way he'd seen people do in the movies. Who was in the office? He and Locke were the only ones who had keys. Gavin cocked his head, straining to hear. The noises seemed to be coming from the conference room. A woman talking, or crying, or moaning. She was saying Locke's name. So Locke was here. A second later, Gavin heard Locke say, clear as a bell,
"Oh, Claire. Jesus."
Okay, Gavin thought.
Okay.
He had walked in on something, a big-time something between Locke and Claire. Gavin felt like he was spinning. It just wasn't possible, was it? He had entertained the idea that Locke was hiding something, and an affair with Claire had crossed Gavin's mind, though he'd immediately dismissed it. But to have unearthed it now, like this, was hideous. He must leave. But Gavin was confused, both horrified and curious, like a rubbernecker at a traffic accident. He continued